Hello and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien and joining me today once again is Semantic Threat Researcher Bridget O'Gorman. In this week's podcast, we'll be talking about how Russian espionage actors are now exploiting the Felina vulnerability, the release of the latest version of Metasploit, and a new phishing campaign that's been underway on Facebook. But first, let's turn to ransomware, because as usual, there's been lots happening in the world of ransomware. And we'll start with Black Cat, because there's been a couple of stories about that in the news this week, Bridget.
Yeah, there has been. I might give a bit of background on Black Cat first, because I guess it's kind of a relatively new ransomware. But it is one that has become, I would say, increasingly active over the last couple of months. So Black Cat, which is also sometimes identified as Novirus or ALF, it first appeared back in November 2021. And I think we might have discussed it at the time because it sparked a lot of interest because it was coded in Rust, which was the first time we'd seen a kind of commercially distributed ransomware that was coded in that programming language. And Rust is kind of considered a fairly, I suppose, complex language to kind of code something in. And while initially it was thought, you know, that Black Cat was kind of a new ransomware operation, I think the widely held belief now is that Black Cat is actually the latest ransomware rebrand from a group we track as Coreed. So they're the operators, basically the group behind who were behind the Dark Side and the Blackmail ransomware strains that obviously caused a lot of headlines last year. And Black Cat itself has said that the people behind it are former affiliates of Coreed. But I think many security researchers believe that it is actually the kind of Coreed developers themselves who are actually behind it, and it is just their latest kind of rebrand. And the gang has been very active, with the FBI estimating in March that Black Cat had been used in ransomware attacks on at least 60 organizations worldwide since it launched in November. But, you know, that was probably realistically a very conservative estimate.
Okay, so let's turn to the latest events. Why has Black Cat been in the news this week?
Well, firstly, Microsoft published a blog about it, and among other things that it detailed in the blog, it said that vulnerabilities in Microsoft Exchange Server were being targeted by some of the actors who were delivering Black Cat. Now, Black Cat is, operates as a ransomware as a service, which means it is distributed by affiliates. So I suppose the tactics that are used to distribute it can vary, you know, depending on what group of affiliates are distributing it. So Microsoft said that while the most common entry vectors for actors deploying Black Cat remains remote desktop applications and compromised credentials, they did observe an incident where attackers took advantage of an unpatched Exchange server to enter the target organization. Now, Microsoft didn't specify the Exchange vulnerabilities that were exploited, but it did link to a security advisory from March 2021 that contained guidance on mitigating proxy logon attacks. So it seems likely that they were the vulnerabilities in question, which seems to indicate that this server has been left, you know, unpatched for quite a while. And in this attack, the ransomware attackers, they took their time really moving through the victim's network. They stole credentials, they were exfiltrating information. And then 2 weeks after the initial compromise of the unpatched Exchange server, the Black Cat ransomware was deployed across the network via PSExec. And Microsoft also said in its blogs that several cybercrime groups are now affiliates for Coreed and are using Black Cat in attacks, with some well-known cybercrime groups having switched from using other ransomware such as Hive to Black Cat in recent times.
Okay, so it looks like they're kind of picking up a bit of market share, for want of a better word. And there's been a few new features, I gathered, that have been added to their data leak site as well.
Yeah, well, in fact, they've set up a new dedicated website that they've created that allows the customers and the employees of organizations that have been victims of a Black Cat attack to check if their own personal data was stolen in an attack. So this is definitely a bit of an evolution of the group's tactics, and it's likely an effort by the gang to apply additional pressure on victim organizations to pay. You know, customers of organizations are unlikely to be happy if they're able to search on a website and discover, you know, confidential information about themselves or their business. So worryingly for victims of Black Cat as well, this new website is available on the public internet, not the dark web, meaning that it is indexable by search engines. And so it's likely that the information contained in it could turn up in search results. So this is an interesting development. And it'll be interesting to see if any other ransomware guys kind of follow suit by doing something similar, kind of setting up this kind of searchable database to increase pressure on victims. I mean, we know from the past that once one ransomware gang starts doing something, you know, if it looks like it's successful, then others tend to follow suit. So this might be something to kind of keep an eye on, see if it becomes more commonplace.
Yeah, you're right. It's a very good point. They all seem to watch each other, and they're very quick to jump on the bandwagon when somebody finds something that works. Mm-hmm. In other ransomware news, we look at NetWalker now. The US authorities, they've released some information that they were able to gather after they took down that guy.
Yeah, so the FBI's Ryan Frampton and the Justice Department's Carlton Gammons, they were speaking at the RSA conference, which was on last week, about the investigation into the NetWalker group, which saw law enforcement seize the group's back-end servers at just, the end of 2020. And the investigators, when they looked, you know, this gave them access, basically, to heaps of information about the ransomware gang and its operations. And they found that less than one quarter, a lot less than one quarter of NetWalker victims actually reported that they have been a victim of ransomware to law enforcement. So the FBI said it had been able to fully identify 450 victims from the information on NetWalker servers. And of those, only 115 had filed a report about being a victim of ransomware. But NetWalker servers actually contained more than 1,000 bills. So that's basically different versions of the NetWalker ransomware that have been customized for victims. You know, so the true number of victims could be more than 1,000. With investigators saying they will likely never know the true number. So it seems like the true number of victims actually reporting to the FBI was a lot smaller than one quarter. They also said that NetWalker had hit victims on every single continent, barring Antarctica. And while victims who reported the ransomware attacks to the FBI had admitted to paying $6.7 million to NetWalker, the information that the investigators were able to find when they were investigating indicates that the group actually successfully extorted nearly $60 million from victims, prompting one of the investigators to say that whatever numbers you see in the public, the ransoms paid are probably way higher than that. And I would say that that's probably, a statement you could probably take to be true for most ransomware groups. And the FBI said that at least 200 victims had paid out ransoms to NetWalker, with the highest single ransom paid to the group being $3 million. And the average ransom payment received by the group was $196,000, which is also quite significant. So it seems like, you know, they were quite successful when it came to making money, whoever was behind NetWalker.
That's really interesting, all right. And it kind of it reminds me of, I think there was a U.S. Senate hearing where senators were complaining about how ransomware attacks were underreported and this lack of data on the true extent of the problem was kind of hindering their ability to tackle it. This information kind of backs it up, and the number of victims involved, you know, a few hundred, I think it's big enough of a sample size mm-hmm. to maybe give a clue as to, you know, what's kind of going on across the ransomware world and not just with NetWalker. Yeah, so it's super interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting, definitely. But let's turn to you now, Dick, because I think there were a few other ransomware developments as well that you want to talk about.
Yeah, a couple of little things that I thought were interesting. So the first thing is that I spotted a bit of research earlier on this week by our peers in Palo Alto Unit 42, and this was into the HelloXD ransomware. So HelloXD was originally not the most novel of threats. It first appeared in November 2021, and it was based around leaked source code from the older Babook ransomware family. However, whoever's running it now has started to make some subtle tweaks to the operation. So Unit 42 said they'd rolled out a new version of their ransomware payload. And the big difference there was that they changed the encryption routine and they replaced what was the modified HC128 algorithm with the Rabbit symmetric cipher. So that's all, you know, fairly routine for a ransomware operation like this. But there was another little detail that was quite interesting because some of the newer samples have a secondary payload embedded. And that was a variant of open source malware called Micro Backdoor. And this backdoor is, you know, it's kind of your standard backdoor. It has all the usual functionality. It allows the attackers to browse the file system, upload and download files, execute commands and whatnot. So the obvious question is, why are they doing this? Because, you know, when you think about it, in order to get the capability to deploy the ransomware payload across the organization's network, you pretty much have to have backdoor access already. So what does this thing add to the party? Unit 42 suggested that there was one explanation was that the attackers might want to use it to monitor ransom systems for blue team and incident response activity, sort of monitor the company's response to a ransomware attack, maybe. So possibly maybe with a view to perfecting their techniques for future attacks, maybe seeing like where they went wrong or mistakes they made. However, you know, this explanation is not set in stone or definite. Palo Alto themselves said cases like this of a post-compromise installation of backdoors are quite rare. So that hypothesis really isn't set in stone. So I guess the interesting thing maybe to kind of see if this ransomware operation keeps doing this, keeps persisting with this tactic going forward.
Yeah, that is quite interesting. It would be interesting if they were, yeah, trying to kind of learn and improve their tactics. That would be an interesting move. And there was another ransomware story then as well about Roblox, or involving Roblox, I should say.
Yeah, it was kind of a funny one. It was uncovered by the Malware Hunter team. So a new family of ransomware, which is called Wanna Friend Me, is asking its victims to purchase the decryption key, not with cryptocurrencies, as is usually the case, but with the in-game currency for Roblox, which is a very popular game with children, I believe. I sound like somebody's uncle when I say that. Roblox is it's an online gaming platform, but I think it also allows its players to create their own games as well. And things called game passes can be created and sold by Roblox developers to give players special access to restricted areas in game, items and power-ups and all that stuff. And the game passes can be purchased with an in-game currency called Robux. So anyway, these ransomware authors asked the victims to purchase their decryptor for 1,499 Robux, which sounds like a lot, but it's actually only around $19. So the malware, you know, it's it pretends to be Ryuk, but it's actually a variant of the Chaos ransomware. And it isn't, you know, as ransomware goes, it isn't the most high-end threats, because even if victims pay the ransom, they may not get their files back, because I think Chaos is known it's kind of very buggy ransomware. It tends to wipe files that are larger than 2 megabytes in size rather than encrypt them. So as ransomware goes, it's quite, you know, it's pretty small potatoes. So why am I talking about this? Well, I guess I was kind of thinking about it in the context of what's going on in global financial markets at the moment. Things are pretty shaky, and one of the shakiest things of all is cryptocurrencies. The value of a lot of cryptocurrencies, I'd say all of them, you know, have plummeted in recent days. And that does beg a few questions, because cryptocurrencies pretty much underpin the entire or most of the cybercrime ecosystem. So it's arguably the advent of cryptocurrencies was one of the key components necessary for the development of the current ransomware business model. So if crypto goes bust, how do these people obtain and launder their money? Well, back in the old days, there was a lot of attempts to gather ransom payments using things like prepaid electronic vouchers and all that. And I guess, you know, if crypto goes south, you could see more and more ransomware groups having to try and get a bit creative like this.
Yeah, that is interesting. Like, as you say, the actual kind of attack itself just seems like, you know, someone fairly unsophisticated. But yeah, it is interesting to think of what they'll come up with if cryptocurrencies do really go to the wall even more than they are at the minute, you know, because definitely crypto has driven so much malicious activity in the last 5 years anyway.
I know. I mean, it going away or it kind of becoming worthless is going to trigger massive change.
But let's now get away entirely from ransomware. I think we've devoted a good bit of time to it. You also wanted to talk about Metasploit. There's a major new update, is there?
Yes, there is. I thought it was worthy of a brief discussion because we were talking a lot about our recent white paper all about commodity malware a few weeks ago, and Metasploit was one of the things that we mentioned in that paper. So to bring people up to speed, what is Metasploit? It is a professionally developed penetration testing tool. There is a commercial version available for people who want to purchase it, but there's also a publicly available open source version available known as Metasploit Framework. Like most penetration testing tools, Metasploit is more like a tool set rather than a tool. It's modular in nature, and it allows its users to, you know, choose an exploit to use against a targeted system and then a particular payload in order to deliver to that system. And there's more than 500 payloads available for it. So like all penetration testing tool sets, it does have its legitimate uses, maybe penetration testing, but it can also be used for nefarious purposes when it falls into the wrong hands. So it's not the most widely used framework that we've seen used by attackers. That honor certainly falls to Cobalt Strike, but nevertheless, we've seen it used a fair bit in some attacks. It's frequently used to create a reverse shell. It's not up there with Cobalt Strike, but it's definitely, you know, among the more popular tools used by attackers.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely a familiar name. And so they've released a new version of it.
Yes. Yeah. They rolled out a major new update, which is, I think, the first since August of last year. And it includes 138 new modules. And 148 new features or enhancements. So there's a lot going on there, in other words. So to give you a flavor of the kind of stuff they've introduced, there's a VMware vCenter specific exploit that also leverages the Log4Shell vulnerability and provides the attacker with remote code execution. There's a Zixel firewall exploit that also provides remote code execution. There's a bunch of privilege escalation exploits and so on. So anyway, the reason I wanted to talk about it is to use this as an example to stress that the threat posed by commodity malware, these penetration testing frameworks, which when they're in the hands of real live attackers, is quite significant because they're not static threats. They're professionally developed, they're constantly evolving, they're always coming up with new techniques to bypass better security, they're baking in newly discovered exploits and so on. So, you know, you can't be complacent about these things, and there is kind of an arms race going on that isn't going to end anytime soon.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose, you know, there's probably a comparison there with we see the ransomware kind of guys trying out new techniques now or new approaches, and we're seeing new techniques coming into play with these kind of commodity malware tools as well. It just goes to show, yeah, you can never kind of sit in your laurels when it comes to these kind of things.
Exactly.
And then finally from you as well, Folina, we discussed it a lot, I think, in the last podcast. But the Russians are using it now as well, are they?
Yes, they are. Yeah, no sooner was it patched than news comes in that its usage is widening. So as anyone listening last time around will know, Folina was a zero-day vulnerability which occurred in the Microsoft Windows Support Diagnostics tool. Attackers could leverage Microsoft's Office ability to retrieve templates for remote locations, to retrieve their own HTML, and then use this MSDT to start running PowerShell scripts. And especially worryingly, if you bake this exploit into an RTF file, it was a zero-click exploit, meaning you didn't even have to open the document. The exploit would trigger from the preview.
So how are the Russians exploiting it then, Dick?
Well, not surprisingly, it is being used against targets in Ukraine. According to an alert that was published by the Ukraine Computer Emergency Response Team, known as CERT-UA, a lot of media organizations in the country were being targeted with a phishing campaign. And the emails had a subject line that said list of links to interactive maps. So apparently at least 500 people working for these media organizations all received these emails. And then if you opened up the email, it had an attachment called list of links interactive maps.docx. And if you opened it up on a vulnerable system, it loaded a HTML file and it executed code that downloaded malware known as Crescent Imp. And CERT-UA said they were reasonably confident that this was linked to the Sandworm group, which is believed to be part of Russian military intelligence and has a fairly extensive track record of attacking targets in Ukraine.
Yeah, absolutely. We've often mentioned Sandworm in this context before. And things are kind of heating up, I suppose, in the cyber front there at the moment again, aren't they?
Yeah, they kind of are. I mean, we didn't hear a lot on the cyber front for a couple of weeks, but things heated up a bit recently because what happened 2 weeks ago was that the US Cyber Command Chief, General Paul Nakasone, if I'm pronouncing his name right, he took quite unusual step of publicly acknowledging that the US had mounted offensive cyber operations in support of Ukraine. It is unusual in the sense that I think there is a widespread understanding that the US, you know, would on occasion do offensive cyber operations, but they never, you know, they'd never talk about it. But anyway, this admission or acknowledgement has triggered quite a bit of saber rattling from other countries. Not surprisingly, Russia has expressed some strong opinions about it. A spokesman from the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs said that Washington was deliberately lowering the threshold for the combat use of ICT. And they said the militarization of the information space and attempts to turn it into an area of interstate confrontation have greatly increased the threat of a direct military clash with unpredictable consequences. So, you know, quite obviously attempting to issue a pretty stern warning there. But, you know, while Russia was obviously going to respond to something like that, the Chinese government also had something to say. And they said that the US needed to explain themselves to the international community about how these hacking operations were consistent with their professed position of not engaging directly in the conflict. Interesting development. Obviously, the US, you know, they don't usually say this. So they obviously had their reasons for saying this. But Russia and China definitely not happy about it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was obviously going to antagonize them when the US came out with this, so yeah, it would be interesting to see if there was some more of a deeper reason behind it.
Yeah, we may find out in time. Mm-hmm. Okay, finally, we have one more from you. You wanted to talk about a phishing campaign that's been happening on Facebook.
Yeah, I just thought this was kind of interesting, as you know, obviously we hear and talk so much about what we were just discussing, you know, nation state activity, as well as ransomware, the huge amounts of money, you know, that are made by criminals in that space. But I just thought this story was a bit interesting because I guess it shows how big money can still be made, I guess, using more kind of old school tactics, you know, for want of a better word as well. I mean, even the fact that it's Facebook, you know, being exploited is kind of old school. I don't think there's anyone under 30 probably on Facebook at this stage. But this story comes from researchers at phishing prevention company Pixum, who details an ongoing Facebook phishing campaign that they estimate could have stolen hundreds of millions of credentials and possibly made its operators as much as $59 million. Now, the campaign has only been running since late 2021, but it appears to have already been highly successful, with one of around 400 landing pages that are used by the attackers having received more than 11 million visitors. And the attack begins basically, you know, as a link sent via Facebook direct message from a compromised account, presumably to that account's contacts. Anyone clicking on the link then is redirected through malvertising pages in order to rack up views and clicks before they then reach a fake Facebook login page. And that page then leads to advert landing pages that then generate additional revenue for the campaign's organisers. And obviously as well, they're harvesting credentials there as well with the fake Facebook login page so that they can, you know, compromise more accounts and the cycle continues basically. And in order to avoid Facebook's phishing detection methods, the campaign used, you know, basically app like link shorteners, like app deployment services like glitch.me or famous.co and amaze.co to begin the redirection chain. And Pixel said that, you know, in terms of what lands in Facebook users' message boxes, you know, it's a link generated. The links are generated using a legitimate service that Facebook basically couldn't block outright because then they would be blocking legitimate apps and links as well. So basically, it's kind of, I suppose, another sort of living off the land technique, really. And the attackers behind the campaign, who reportedly spoke to a researcher in late 2021, and I think there have been a little bit of prior reporting on this campaign earlier in the year. But the fact that it's still ongoing, despite that kind of reporting earlier in the year, is definitely notable. They said that they made $150 for every 1,000 visits from US Facebook users. And from what Pixum calculated, that puts the campaign's earnings at $59 million. However, the company did say that the attacker is probably exaggerating about the amount of money they're making. But at the same time, because the campaign is so big, you know, the revenue is still likely to be very significant and well up into the millions, purely due to the size of the campaign. So I just thought it was an interesting one because, you know, we talk so much about ransomware actors, you know, that kind of activity, but these kind of basically like ad fraud type of campaigns can still make people a lot of money as well.
Yeah, it's easy to write some of this stuff off as old news or, you know, unsophisticated threats, but like even if they're exaggerating a bit, they're still making a whole lot of money.
Yeah, it's kind of like the romance scams, you know. I mean, they're around for a million years, but they're still making people lots of money too, you know.
Yeah. Okay, let's wrap it up there. That's all we have time for this week. If you've been enjoying our podcast, please do subscribe to avoid missing out on all of the action in the future. You can also follow us on Twitter at Threat Intel. If you'd like to read our latest research, check out our blog, which can be found at semantic-enterprise-blogs.security.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time, but until then, thank you and goodbye.